All right. I think we have gotten enough people out to move on to case number 4, Parrott versus Astru, 12-16-53. Mr. Horn. I wouldn't want you to have to talk over that much commotion, Mr. Horn.
Your Honors, Counsel, ladies and gentlemen, may it please the Court. I'm John Horn. I represent Kendall Parrott, the appellant here, from an adverse ALJ decision. And the principal issue is, did Parrott acquire transferable skills at his job? The ALJ decided that Parrott had a sedentary RFC, and at step 5 of the proceeding, it was the commissioner's burden to show that Parrott had transferable skills, or the claim should have been allowed at that point as of his 50th birthday, which was, I believe, in October 2008. The skills that
because he's down at the sedentary level, right?
Right.
Yeah.
The ALJ found that he was capable of sedentary work.
Mm-hmm.
The
Court of Appeals judge, but go ahead.
Okay. The Court of Appeals. Vocational expert testified that writing, coordinating, adjusting actions in relation to others, active listening, problem identification, or information gathering were transferable skills. And we maintained at that point that I maintained at that point that they were not transferable skills because they were mere aptitudes.
So you think transferable skills are something like knowing how to create an Excel spreadsheet or something like that?
Well, a transferable skill, yes, it would be. The SSR 82-41 says that a transferable skill is a knowledge of a work activity that requires the exercise of significant judgment that goes beyond the carrying out of simple job duties and is acquired through performance of an occupation which is above the unskilled level. And where the ALJ went wrong here is, first of all, the testimony of the vocational expert was at variance with that. I believe it's 102 of the record, the vocational expert testified that, no, it didn't need to be acquired at that previous job. It could have been brought to the previous job.
Well, I mean, that's not too disturbing, because if you've got skills that are useful in more than one line of work, it seems that that might support the idea that there's work you can do. I do understand. I mean, would it be different if the vocational expert, I'm looking at this list of items that the vocational expert identified, writing. So if the vocational expert had said, you know, this person worked for 4 years as a journalist and can write quickly and effectively, you know, for your website or something, I mean, that, in some circumstances, writing could be a transferable skill, don't you think?
It would have to be writing something specific. For example, let's say the vocational expert had testified that drawing was a transferable skill. He would have been wrong, but drawing a blueprint, that's a transferable skill because 82-41 mentions that. Or writing a sonnet. Or speaking probably another language, as the dictionary defines speaking.
What about just being a public relations person, you know, speaking, you know, presenting to the public the position of the employer? There's some people who speak all the time.
It's got to be particular speaking skill. If the person brought it to the position, it's not a skill as it's contemplated by the Social Security ruling let's see what it is. The regulation 404, 20 CFR 404-1565.
Mm-hmm.
The vocational expert suggested that it took that speaking was not just talking; it was conveying information. Well, a 3-year-old child who tells his mother that he's hungry is conveying information. The vocational expert...
Okay, Counselor, you're taking this way out of context. He worked for over 15 years as a park district director in a suburban community. That's a professional position that involves, you know, processing information, writing, interacting with the public, managing the system in a way that makes your 3-year-old analogy quite inapt.
Well, the vocational expert also testified that it took 4 to 10 years for Mr. Parrott to learn to convey information as he spoke.
But as he comes to the hearing, he's got those skills. He learned them on the job for the Village of Harvey, Illinois, where he worked for over 15 years in that capacity and was entrusted with that significant responsibility. Those go beyond mere aptitudes.
I think you're rewriting the ALJ's decision, because that's not what the ALJ's decision says. She said writing, coordinating, adjusting actions in relation to others, active listening, problem identification, or information gathering.
Right. It's clear she's tying that to his relevant work history, which was over 15 years in this essentially managerial role over the parks in Harvey, Illinois, and before that he was a truant officer.
But
that's all in her report.
You're inferring things and rewriting things in a way that violates the Chenery decision. We are stuck with the ALJ's decision as it is on paper.
Yes, but we read it in its totality. We don't take things out of context. She's clearly considering it in the context of his past work history. She may not have connected the dots with the specificity that you're suggesting she ought to have, but we have to read it as a whole.
Every single case on this subject says that your approach is wrong. Drager, Weaver, Ellington, and this court's own Villano case say that these are mere generalities and that you are mistaken. Beyond this point, the ALJ didn't consider evidence of Mr. Parrott's actual limitations, manipulative, visual, and audio. The ALJ also ran afoul of this court's ruling in O'Connor Spinner. So, this court's action should be remand for award of benefits as of Parrott's 50th birthday, and send the case back to determine whether benefits should have been awarded earlier. It'll be a closed period of disability. Any other questions?
You may save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from Ms. Siegel.
My name is Catherine Siegel. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this case.
Am I wrong, as your opponent suggests?
No, absolutely not. You're correct, Your Honor. And actually, we don't have to guess about hypothetical possibilities for what transferable skills are in this case, because the vocational expert testified very clearly about what the claimant's transferable skills were. At the initial part of the vocational expert's testimony, he stated that the claimant had a skilled work history, and he identified that as a specific vocational preparation level of 7 or 8. The truant officer was 7. The park district superintendent was an 8, which is a very high level. In the skills, it ranges between 5 and 9 for skilled work, and so it's on the higher level of skilled work. Then he talked about specific skills that the claimant had from that job, and that's where we come in with the testimony about the skills about the speaking and the writing and coordinating and adjusting actions in relation to others, the active listening, problem identification, and information gathering. These are all related to communication.
I mean, this is appearing at page 16 and 17 of the ALJ's opinion, and it's certainly absolutely clear from page 16 that the vocational expert is tying this list of skills to the past relevant work as a truant officer and a recreation supervisor. From this occupational experience, the claimant acquired the following skills. Here's
Correct.
The list. And then there's an elaboration on the next page. My problem with the, at least some items on this list is that they are phrased in such a general way that I think you could probably apply them to practically everything. You know, active listening, problem identification, information gathering. It doesn't seem to me to have any kind of if I put that on a resume and was trying to get a job from it, some employer would look and scratch his head and say, well, what am I supposed to take from that? You're an active listener? Good for you. I don't see the kind of specificity of skill from that list.
They're communication skills, and they're related to the job. I'm not sure how it would possibly get more specific than that. I mean, if you're talking about being able to coordinate employees. I mean, he was a supervisor. He was a high-level executive.
Exactly, and that's what you would say for the. I mean, transferable skills. If you have managerial skills, if you have experience as a supervisor, supervising a staff of X, a staff of 5, a staff of 2, a staff of 35, whatever it is, there are ways of expressing that would. Again, imagine your hypothetical resume. You know, you don't just say, I'm the great communicator. I mean, you say what it is the new employer can draw on from your old experience.
And here that vocational expert said those were communication skills. He didn't identify managerial skills. He identified communication skills as the skill that this claimant had. And he explained how a skill becomes transferable. That was something that he was questioned about. The vocational expert was questioned by the claimant's counsel, what is the difference between something that is just something you bring, an aptitude that you bring into a job like speaking, and when does it get to the level that you can use it? And what he said was that it becomes transferable when your job demanded it. You use that skill. And then you can use it to get another job. You can use it to transfer to another job. The other job requires the same skill, and you're able to use it because you have it from this previous job.
Mm-hmm.
And what the ALJ found very convincing, and which I think that this court can be very confident to rely upon, was that the context that this testimony was given was in a job that was a very high-level executive position in the government that he held for a very long time. These are the types of skills that would have been developed over the course of a 15-year career at this one job alone. So it would rise to the level of a skill at that point. Your ability to communicate is going to be at a much higher level when you're an executive in the government than it would be if you're just coming in as a new employee.
Right, and in this area, as in others, the general descriptive terms have to be taken in their specific factual context. Nothing in our case law suggests that we divorce general terms from their context.
That's correct. And what's important, too, in this case is that the vocational expert then considered those transferable skills when considering the hypothetical individual and deciding on what kind of jobs to say that person might be able to do. And in this case, the jobs that he identified actually had a lower specific vocational preparation than what the claimant had been able to perform in the past. The jobs were just a cashier in a hotel or motel and a job as a resident supervisor. And those were in significant numbers, and they fit all the hypothetical restrictions that were put before the vocational expert.
There was one impairment that was omitted from the hypothetical related to the claimant's hearing impairment.
The hearing
impairment. I mean, it's all over the record, and the
right,
ALJ
and
did cover it, but it wasn't part of the.
The ALJ actually talked about why she didn't credit fully the idea that this hearing impairment would have caused a significant limitation such that you would put it in a hypothetical question. She said that she considered his allegations of hearing loss because of this surgery that he had to remove a tumor from his acoustic nerve. And she said that afterwards, when his hearing was tested, it was found that the hearing loss was mild and that he could hear conversation at 6 feet, and that during the hearing itself, she observed that he was able to testify without any difficulty. And also in other medical reports, the doctors talked about him listening to music and doing things that one would not expect a person with profound hearing loss that would limit the claimant.
Well, the hearing loss was on one side, right? The medical evidence shows he has permanent hearing loss in his left ear.
Right.
But perhaps the right ear is enough or something.
Not profound. Hearing loss. It was a mild hearing loss. It's not complete hearing loss in the left ear. It's only a mild hearing loss in the left ear.
Where does it say that?
Let's see. Dr. Patil.
I remember the part about he could hear at the hearing, but that doesn't mean he was hearing out of both ears. Some people have a complete hearing loss in one ear and are still able to follow conversations.
They talk about left ear hearing loss, though. It's so
it's the left ear the with a permanent hearing loss. And I didn't see that the severity of that hearing loss was trivial. I saw that it was the left ear, but as far as I could tell, nothing wrong with the right ear.
Well, the claimant was able to communicate at the hearing and also able to communicate on the telephone. That was at 5:32.
The phone in your right ear. You don't put it on your left ear. Okay, well, we'll look
at that. You're left-handed, you might.
The other restriction that I wanted to, the other aspect of the case that I wanted to make sure that you understood was that the administrative law judge also obtained the testimony of a medical expert to talk about the claimant's mental health impairments and history, and that her findings tracked medical expert's testimony very closely, and that the restrictions that the medical expert said the claimant had, the ALJ adopted and was very convinced by. Now the claimant's mentioned that he felt that there was an O'Connor spinner issue. In that case, the court found that the administrative law judge did not include all of the limitations in the hypothetical question to the vocational expert that the ALJ had included in the decision. We don't have that situation here at all. We have a residual functional capacity finding that has every restriction that was included in the hypothetical question to the vocational expert, so that these track each other. And that is based on the medical expert's testimony at the hearing. To the extent that there is a moderate concentration, persistence, and pace finding, it has to do with step 3 of the case, which is dealing with the claimants, whether they meet or equal a listing. And that's a preliminary finding. If you meet a marked restriction in the various B criterias, you're automatically found disabled. In this case, the ALJ relied on the medical expert's testimony that mild and moderate restrictions were in those B criteria, and that's how that finding made its way into the decision. It's not a part of the functional capacity finding specifically.
Thank you very much.
And I ask you to affirm the commission.
Anything further, Mr. Horn?
Yes.
How much time does he have? 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
With respect to the left ear, some pages would be 24, 646, 1165, and 1166. With respect to O'Connor Spinner, I disagree emphatically with the government. But the heart of O'Connor Spinner is complexity versus the ability to concentrate. And the ALJ found that Mr. Parrott was moderately limited in concentration, persistence, and pace. That's apples and oranges, as this court found in O'Connor Spinner. Just because he might have been able to do something a little bit more complex doesn't mean he could concentrate it on it as long. And finally, let me give some examples of what 8241 gives as examples of skill, transferable skills. We're talking about making precise measurements, reading blueprints, and setting up and operating complex machinery, much more than these generalities that the vocational expert testified to. His testimony was at variance with the Social Security regulations. And because the commissioner has not met his burden at step five of the proceedings, that's why the case should be remanded for award of benefits.
Okay, I think that will do. Thank you very much. We will take the case under advisement.